we keep asking ourselves, here on America Tonight and everywhere else, how much damage is being done to the wetlands, the beaches, marine life, wildlife, the psyche of the people who live in these areas. It's just been a horrible thing to watch, no doubt about it. Happy to be joined by Dr. Rob Moyer, an environmental scientist with the Ocean River Institute. Hey, Rob, how are you?
I'm very well.
You know, somebody told me last week you were in D.C. for Ocean Week. And I was like, Ocean Week, I've heard of this. I've been dying to ask you this question, but what do you do at Ocean Week?
Well, it was World Ocean Day, actually. It was Tuesday, and it was a declaration by the U.N. some years ago. And on World Ocean Day, different supporters for national marine estuaries, the national marine sanctuaries, gathered together in Washington on Tuesday. And we heard from Philippe Cousteau and Jean-Michel Cousteau, and we recognized the efforts of different environmentalists to save the oceans.
Yeah, so boy, I bet there was a lot of interesting conversation there, and it had to be, some of it certainly off the mic and around the mic had to be centered around what's going on in the Gulf of Mexico, the oil spill disaster. Now it's been 2+ months. Initially, what was your reaction to it, and what are you thinking now with the days that keep clicking off?
Well, initially, my reaction was utter shock that we would permit people to drill in 5,000 feet of water. There, I know of 350 or so oil wells in 600 feet or less of water, but to be drilling in such deep water, you know, I was just thinking of the clown trying to spin plates on sticks and having a stick, you know, 5,000 feet long. It's just incomprehensible. And, of course, they had no ability to stop the gushing of the oil coming in there. So it's just total shock.
Yeah,
and, of course, the shock is also oil spills traditionally have been oil tankers on the surface, and the oil spreads across the surface because it's lighter than water. But here it's coming up from 5,000 feet deep and mixing into the water, and we don't know how it's mixing.
Yeah, and how scary is that? And it's like we keep watching these oil plumes, and we keep hearing about the oil plumes. And I've had a lot of callers say, well, really, what are the plumes? What difference does it make? Isn't it just that same old oil that's pouring out? So how significant is that?
Oh, it's incomprehensible. They're reporting, you know, 20-mile wide or wider plumes or pools of oily water. But the problem is that it's not just, you know, an oil slick. You get your chamois out and soak up and pick up with hair or hay or something. But what's happening here is when the oil comes to the surface, BP is spraying dispersants that are to make the oil glom together and sink down out of sight. And it turns out the dispersants are more chemically harmful, cancerous, endocrine-disrupting chemicals than the oil itself is. And so you have this oil coming up from 5,000 feet, and it's being met by these globs coming down from the surface, and they're just kind of suspended in mid-water. So we've polluted the whole water column, not just the surface.
Boy. And here's the really confusing thing. Everybody's looking for blame. Everybody's looking to say, well, what can we do now? What do we do now? And I didn't even realize this. I have a brother who's an attorney, and he was telling me, look up how many laws there are. And it turns out there are over somewhere in the neighborhood of 140-something laws, and there are too many agencies that actually are trying to regulate the oceans, the coastlines, and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, you deal in this. What do you think the government needs to do to pull this all together and better coordinate and more comprehensively coordinate what's happening as far as drilling off the coasts and regulations and all that?
Absolutely. Oceanriver.org. We have information on our website. We are 17,000 eco-stewards and environmental guardians who are speaking up to power, and you can join our letters and add your comments. We're asking for three things. First, that the president have a moratorium on all offshore drilling. Second, that he move legislation that'll discourage the use of emitting lots of carbon, that'll promote, you know, green jobs and clean energy. And third, is calling for a national ocean policy, which is what you're referring to. And the president had a task force that went around listening to the different communities of what they could do to better manage the oceans. And yes, there are all those different agencies trying to manage the ocean and 140 different laws, and they need to get together and figure out which, you know, and coordinate so that it doesn't overlap and it's not so chaotic. And if we're going to move to green energy, we need to have it organized so that a windmill builder or a wave energy builder won't have to go through, you know, so many separate different hurdles, but there can be a natural sequence of the regulations that they have to meet and conditions they have to achieve to get there. So oceanriver.org to see those letters and stuff.
So when we look at what's happening in the Gulf of Mexico, and I started off saying that the damage to the wetlands and the beaches and marine life and everything, I don't know that we can necessarily measure it at this point because, of course, it's still going on. But the last I heard, I checked today, and it's 25 miles into the wetlands. How do you get oil out of the wetlands? I mean, this is going to destroy a lot of that environment, isn't it?
It is. It doesn't come out. I mean, we've had spills in many places, in Buzzards Bay here, close to Massachusetts where I am, it's in Massachusetts, there was a spill 40 years ago, and you still find oil in the marshes from that spill. You go to Stewart, Alaska, and you can pick up the rocks, and they're oily from Valdez and stuff. Oil is going to be part of these marshes for a century or more. Even though there are oil-reducing bacteria, they can't work that fast.
Yeah, you talked about, I mentioned this, that you're with the Ocean River Institute. I know it's a nonprofit. How long has it been around, and what was initially, why was it formed?
We came together because we wanted to have a Massachusetts ocean planning process, which is what we're asking now the President Obama to pass. And so I was contracted to pull people together who would push government to do that. And it was also formed because I have started and been involved with local watershed groups that are watching their environment. And these groups start off and they live very close, hand to mouth, and they will run into obstacles like lose their equipment or lose a director, and they'll turn to their funding sources and they'll be told, no, we can't help you, you're not on our strategic plan, or, you know, we did it before. So the Ocean River Institute is networked with all these different efforts, and we move quickly and episodically to address situations. So right now Florida is addressing getting nutrients from flowing into the rivers. The rivers are just green and slimy from so much nutrients. And the dolphins in Indian River Lagoon have skin, fungi-eating skin infections and stuff that are a result of too much nutrients. And so oceanriver.org people are pushing Governor Crist to make sure that the EPA, you know, limits the amount of nutrients that are flowing in. Similar campaigns to save beluga whales and wolffish in the Atlantic Ocean. These are situations where, you know, a sudden outspeaking of lots of people will impact decision makers who are dealing with problems in the moment.
Yeah. Rob, thanks so much. This was interesting talking to you. There's obviously things that people can do, and it is all about paying attention. It's learning about the things around you, not realizing what's going on. And I'm sure that's what you do. A lot of it is education, isn't it?
Yes. The three things you can do to save the oceans, to clean up our waterways, is to look locally, think locally, and act locally.
All right, Rob, thanks. We appreciate your time here on America Tonight.
It's the number one reason for slow and clogged bath drains. That's right, hair. And the number one way to open drains plugged with hair? The drain clog. Stop standing in dirty bath water. Stop using dangerous chemicals. Just push the drain claw past the pop-up in your sink or tub, twist, and pull. You'll be shocked at what this little tool can pull out of your drain. The drain claw has over 100 tiny hooks that claw through hair, toothpaste, and shampoo that slows and clogs your drains. See how it works right now at thedrainclaw.com. The drain claw is made in the USA and is the safest, easiest, most environmentally friendly solution to
unclog bath drains. Get one for $6.99 or three for $15. The drain claw can be used over and over. Don't be fooled by substitutes. Buy the original. Buy the drain claw. Order now at thedrainclaw.com. That's the drain claw at thedrainclaw.com.
Good day, Jim Newcomer from Midas Resources. June 14, 2010. Gold opened this morning at $12,2690. A 1 ounce gold coin can be purchased for $12,5960, $6,2990 for a half ounce, or $3,1490 for the quarter ounce. That's $12,5960, $6,2990, or $3,1490.
Making the right decision is a challenge to investors. Are we going to see economic growth, slide into a recession, or worse, depression? Many investors are turning to gold as a common sense alternative to traditional paper investments. Midas has put together a powerful book titled 10 Reasons to Own Gold. Discussing costs, benefits, risks, the book is free and can be yours by calling 800-686-2237. Paper investments are dwarfed by gold's 6,000-year history. Discover how gold can be right for you and your IRA by calling 800-686-2237. Whether buying or it's time for you to sell, this book is free. Call 800-686-2237.
The problem.
How do I cook food without power?
How do I light my home with no electricity?
How do I get emergency radio broadcast?
How can I make safe drinking water?
When your power goes out, the solution for cooking, baking, home lighting, listening to the radio, and producing clean water is the Family Emergency Kit from KeroStove. KeroStove has been in business for over 12 years with the largest selection of kerosene stoves and family preparedness supplies in the U.S. Now, get the Family Emergency Kit at KEROstove.com for only $4.29 plus shipping, a savings of nearly $200. It's perfect for off-the-grid living. Call 888-395-1164 today. That's 888-395-1164 and ask about weekly specials or check the specials online each week at KEROstove.com. Again, call 888-395-1164 or go to KEROstove.com. Kero Stove for family emergency solutions.
Enforcement law goes into effect in 6 weeks, folks. You know that. We've been talking about it. In anticipation of that happening, Arizona is now saying, although the statistics are pretty loose, that Hispanics, both legal and illegal, are leaving the state. Something similar happened in 2007 after the state passed then a law imposing penalties on businesses that hired them. So, and that's according to Homeland Security. They said 100,000 illegals left Arizona then. So the question becomes, where do they go and what's the impact on the state of Arizona? Pleased to be joined by immigration attorney Jaime Barron, who joins us now on ATN to help us break it all down. Jaime, how you doing?
Good. Hi, how are you? Good evening.
Good evening to you, too. Hey, they're saying now, like through schools and through certain businesses, what they can tell, at least in Arizona, like I said, there's no hard statistics, but that there's been a pullback. A lot of money's not being spent, and it looks like people are saving up to leave. Do you think that's true? Do you think a lot of Hispanics, both legal and illegal, will just leave Arizona because they're furious or because also they don't want to get caught? Do you think there's a lot of truth in that?
Well, I think there is fear. And if people fear that they will be detained, arrested, or harassed, even for suspicion of being illegal, then a lot of people might consider moving. Other states that might benefit from this exodus would be Texas, California, and possibly New Mexico. Now, people have to understand that this is a bad thing because it might happen like the towns that depended on, for example, the building of vehicles of General Motors and all that. When the business leaves, there's going to be a recession, and this is going to be a recession on top of a recession, so it might severely affect the economy of Arizona.
So you say, ironically, Arizona taking the tough stance instead of it being, okay, hey, we're going to try to, you know, we're being overrun and we're going to try to crack down here and just enforce something that was on the books. We're going to tweak it. We're going to call it a new tough immigration law. But instead, it's going to actually backfire on the governor and the state legislature.
It might severely backfire because, for example, let's say, I don't know, I'm just going to make up numbers here. Let's say 1,000 people are afraid of this law. Legal, illegal aliens, people who are not criminals, and they flee. And let's say an average of these people making maybe $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 a year, buying houses, vehicles, spending money, buying clothes at Walmart or whatever. Now they're going to move. They're going to take their money, and they're going to invest it or spend it in other states. And you multiply that for maybe a couple of 100,000 people that might consider moving, and there's suddenly a horrible outflux of money that's leaving the states. So, yes, it might severely affect the economy of the state of Arizona.
Do you think, Jaime, because we're 6 weeks away, I said, from this law kicking in. And I know a lot of lawsuits have been filed, but so far there's no stay. There's nothing that's happened. Do you think we'll see this law actually kick in at the end of July?
I'm hoping it won't, and hopefully what's going to happen is at the last minute there's going to be something that stops it, and for it to be reanalyzed or at least momentarily frozen, for it to be reconsidered and hopefully taken out of the books.
And so you think that, I know there's a lot of discussion in the legal community, and I've talked to some other lawyers, and they feel like you do. They feel as though it's a sticky situation. It's hard to figure out which way it'll go. But that probably, even if it's in the 11th hour, some judge somewhere will do something to put the brakes on it.
I believe so, because it, in my opinion, it overlaps the federal law. And, you know, under the Supremacy Clause, federal law has to govern over state law. So that's the hope of people who are pro-immigrant. This might be reconsidered, because it won't only affect the pro-immigrants, it will affect anti-immigrants. When they see that a head of lettuce suddenly costs double and your, you know, $3 shoe shine might be $10 now, because it might be an exit to everybody. Even those who are in favor of the law are going to pay the price.
Yeah. Are you finding that you practice out of Texas, out of Dallas, but are you
Correct.
Finding that your phone is ringing off the hook? Are people asking you a bunch of questions about legal status and how can they attain it? Are you finding that more people are starting to call on your services in a different way?
Correct. Sadly, people take action sometimes based on fear. Fear that they might be deported, fear that their economy might, you know, that it might cost them. The government is not raising fees. So, yes, from the point of view of immigration attorneys, there's a lot of demand because people are afraid, so they want to take action, and whoever can legalize is taking action, and also before the government raises fees again.
So explain this process. Somebody asked me this the other day. You're an immigration attorney. Somebody comes to you and says, listen, what do I do? I've been in this country illegally. I love America. I want to change the status. I want to figure out what I need to do. And I've saved up a bunch of money. Jaime, what can I do? How do I have to go back, then come back through? What do I need to do to become legal?
Well, there's a ton of options. Many people don't qualify for anything. The system is created in the theory that nobody would ever stay illegally. But sadly, the truth is there are millions of people who are illegal in the country. So the government modifies the laws. The immigration law changes. It's the second law that changes the most after the tax law. So the government created these laws in 1996 called IRA, which were created to punish terrorists. But really, they don't punish any terrorists, and they punish illegal aliens. And, for example, the law says, well, you have to go back to your country and request a pardon. And this is somebody imagining, you know, might be a soldier who just came back, married somebody, and then this person has to leave the country and risk being barred from returning to the U.S. for a period of 10 years for having been illegal. Of course, if you're a criminal, you serve the time, but you pay a fine and you're allowed to come back or leave the jail. Immigration law is even harsher than criminal law because it doesn't let you pay a fine or do some type of plea bargain, it just bars you. And the odds of getting a pardon are always 50-50. And this is somebody who's married to a U.S. citizen, maybe a member of the armed services, and they suffer as much as the illegal alien. It's horrible.
Wow. So the armed services, I think there's a misconception that, okay, well, if I just sign up, then I've served the country, and now this should clear me. I should be able to, you know, I've gone to Iraq, I've gone to Afghanistan, I love this country, yes, I came here illegally, but boom, now I should be able to get citizenship, but that's not necessarily true from what you're telling us.
Correct. And also, if they're married to somebody who's in illegal status, not necessarily, they won't give them a benefit for having been a member of the armed services. I see this all the time. I have we serve a lot of soldiers, Marines, and people from the Navy that have these issues that they married somebody who's in illegal status, and not even because they're members of the armed services, they're allowed to benefit and help out their family members. So, yeah, it's pretty sad.
Do you think that would make a difference if it was clarified and let's say there was – let's say the president, for example, said, listen, I know there's some confusion and we're working toward doing some different things to rectify the situation that got out of control. And we'll say this, if you serve automatically, whatever, you do a couple of tours, whatever, it's 4 years, et cetera, then you'll get your legal status, period, end of story. Do you think we'd see more people sign up?
Oh, absolutely. When 9/11 hit, people were afraid of immigrants, thinking all immigrants were terrorists, and clearly that's not the case. A lot of immigrants, illegal aliens, said, let me serve, let me die for the U.S., but give me papers. So clearly the loyalty exists. U.S. and Mexico have been always, you know, it's a love-hate relationship, but people who are here illegally have the same patriotism to the U.S., as if they were legal. Sadly, it's been maybe about 40 or 50 years since the government has allowed somebody who's illegal to serve in the armed services. And, you know, hopefully they'll change the law that's saying, hey, you want to serve, you want to go fight, I give you papers. Man, maybe that'll happen. There are laws in books that have disappeared over the years that would solve this problem really easily. There's a law called 245I that allows you to pay a fine. And then you're allowed to legalize. You will pay a penalty for having been illegal. Sadly, they have not returned that law to the books since April 30th of 2001.
Wow.
And, for example, there's another law called temporary protected status that benefits citizens of certain countries that cannot return based on natural disasters like hurricanes or earthquakes or civil strife. It's a simple program called temporary protected status. Allow illegal aliens to register for that program, and then the government will have control of a human who is illegal in the United States. And that doesn't guarantee citizenship, but allows the control of these people. And then there's a mechanism eventually to legalize them.
Well, we know we'll be watching what happens in Arizona. Jaime Barron, once again, thanks so much for joining us on America Tonight.
A pleasure. Thanks very much.
How well and how fast does Heart and Body Extract work to improve blood circulation? Listen.
My name is Ellis, and I am 66 years old, and I live in Jacksonville, Florida. 2 years ago, I was diagnosed as having clogged arteries. I had 70% blockage in one artery leading to my heart. They wanted me to go on Plavix, but I refused, knowing the negative side effects.
Heart and Body Extract is a unique balance, synergy, and proportion of herbs reaching from head to toe at maximum absorption around 95% at the cellular level.
Within the first month, I felt a dramatic difference. The heaviness in my legs was reduced, and within 2 months, I felt completely normal.
Your natural organic herbal formula for heart health is Heart and Body Extract. Heart and Body Extract comes with a 100% ironclad money-back guarantee. Details at hbextract.com or call 866-295-5305 for Heart and Body Extract. Call 866-295-5305, 866-295-5305 for Heart and Body Extract.
You're listening to GCN, Genesis Communication Radio Network.
If you owe the IRS money you can't pay, then listen carefully, because you already know that the problem won't go away by itself. You can get help today from the leading tax expert in the country, Dan Pilla.
Hi, I'm Dan Pilla. The IRS isn't going to just forget about you. Right now, the IRS is hiring thousands of tax collectors to go after delinquent accounts just like yours. That's why you need to take action today, and I can help. I take a simple but proven approach to solving your tax debt problem. First, I stabilize collections so you don't have to worry about wage and bank levies. Next, I build a detailed plan to get your debt reduced to the fullest extent possible, sometimes even eliminated. Finally, I work with you every step of the way to get your problem solved once and for all. So call now for a free consultation. Call 1-800-346-6829.
Dan Pilla will solve your tax problem, guaranteed. He's helped thousands of people, and he can help you too. Call us today at 800-346-6829. That's 800-34-NO-TAX.
We all know that the Berkey water purification systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 4 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey guy offers amazing specials for Berkey water systems. The revolutionary Berkey light systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels, and removes harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey light system today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $209, and the Berkey guy will include three Sport Berkey water bottles and ship everything to you free of charge. That's right, three Sport Berkey water bottles and free shipping, an $87 value, yours free, but only for a limited time. Just call the Berkey guy at 1-877-886-3653 now to order. That's 1-877-886-3653 or order online now at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Times are tough, and you gotta stretch that dollar. A special invitation for listeners to save. Sign up at DoobleyShoppers.com today and start paying the absolute guaranteed lowest internet retail prices for the coolest stuff. New premium brand-name TVs, laptops, watches, camcorders, Blu-ray players, and more. All with factory warranties, just like you'd get from a retail chain, except for the absolute guaranteed lowest internet retail prices. They start low and go lower with our reverse auctions. You save even more with your first $8 auction purchase. Doobly will give you an instant $25 dining certificate good at thousands of nationwide restaurants, plus a $500 vacation discount voucher usable at hundreds of resorts around the U.S. and world. Sign up today at DoobleyShoppers.com. Pay the absolute guaranteed lowest internet retail prices, and listeners receive special rewards. It's worth a peek to keep money in your pocket and the coolest stuff in your home and garage. Sign up today at DoobleyShoppers.com. That's D-U-B-L-I Shoppers.com. You'll be glad you did.
Coast to coast and all those nooks and crannies in between. Kate Delaney, America tonight. So excited about our next guest. We're going to usher him in from our virtual green room. His name is Robert Menard, and he's really like a motivational guy. He wrote a cool book called You Negotiate It. I think I need to hire him as an agent because he needs to negotiate it for me. But the thing that's so neat about Robert is this is something we've talked about for a long time on America Tonight. The need to speak different languages. Everywhere I go, somebody is speaking a different language, but it's not English. Now, we're not going to get into that whole English-Spanish discussion, but I'm serious. You know, if you can speak different languages, imagine the things that you're able to negotiate, honestly. Like if I could speak a little Italian, even a little French, how fun would that be? Well, he speaks all kinds of languages. French is one of his main languages. He also speaks some Italian, a little Russian. He's going to work on the Chinese. Robert, put down the latte and come on in and join us. Seriously, I think it's an incredible feat to be able to speak different languages. Did you just have a gift for that? Was that something that you picked up when you were a kid?
Well, I think we all have a native ability. Certainly those who are thrust into having to learn a language, they learn it because of necessity. But I did speak French as a kid, but I do find that I have an affinity for it, and I like it, and I try to speak just the way the natives do. And it served me well.
So if you were to teach the audience, because we do have a lot of French Canadians that listen to us. We get calls from people in Montreal. Specifically, Sam is one of practically our nightly callers. If we were going to say something in French to Sam, like, hello, how are you? How do you say that?
Well, here's how you would greet him because you have a friendly relationship. You would say, ça va, mon ancien.
Ça va, mon ancien.
Hello, close. Ça va. and then mon ancien, that means, how's it going, my old friend?
There you go.
Yeah, it's a friendly greeting that you would use for someone that you have a relationship with.
Yeah. Now, the French, isn't the French language known for a lot of double entendres? Is that true?
Yeah. Well, that's because the way the language is spoken. Let me give you an example. The French letters E, E accent aigu, which is the accent, and the verb endings ER, ET, AI, and EZ are all pronounced A. On the other hand, the common third-person plural verb ending, which is spelled A-I-E-N-T, is silent. So you're never quite sure which tense is being used. That's why there's so much clarification as opposed to in Italian, where you know just by how the verb ends exactly what the person is, and you never use the personal pronouns because it's understood. It's because of the tense of the verb.
Let's talk about Italian. I have a lot of friends that have been to Italy. I went to Italy a long time ago, and I was very blonde at the time, and I just remember that I was being chased all over the place, and I really think it was because of the blonde hair, and there were so many dark-haired women. So the Italian language itself is supposed to be a romance language, right? Why is it a romance language? What is it about the way the Italians speak?
Well, the romance comes from Roman. So there are the Romance languages. There are five of them: English, I'm sorry, French, Italian, Spanish, Portuguese, and Romanian. So those are all Romance languages. Italian might be considered Romance in a different sense because it is so sonorous. It is so easy on the ears as opposed to the harsh guttural sounds of the French and the very clipped rate at which the Spaniards and Portuguese speak.
Okay, so you got to tell us something in Italian. Since I have some, every once in a while, people get hot under the collar, and you know how that is. They jump on the soapbox, and whatever it is that we're talking about, whether it's the oil spill or something else that's going on in Washington, D.C., the lack of action. If we wanted to tell somebody they were crazy in Italian, how do we say that?
If you're from Jersey, if you're from the Northeast, where there's a large Italian concentration, you'll hear the expression "doozy pots," and people understand that means it's really it has evolved from the Italian "tu e pazzo." "Tu e pazzo"
Ooh.
Means you're crazy, and "pazzo" is spelled P-A-Z-Z-O, like pizza, pazzo.
Uh-huh.
So when people see it written, they're kind of confused. That's where you spell that word. That's where you pronounce that word. But "tu e pazzo," which you're crazy, is
I
often,
like that.
You will often hear it heard said as "tu e pazzo."
Yeah, "tu e pazzo," "tu e pazzo." I'm going to have to say that to my friends back in South Philly who insist on calling red sauce gravy. It's gravy.
Gravy, that's exactly right. That's the expression for it. Yeah.
Exactly. Do you want some more gravy? The first time my friend Lisa Ficarra said that to me, Robert, I had no idea. I'm like, gravy on my pasta? What are you talking about? She's like, you're too Irish. You need to get some Italian in you. Something's wrong with you. So, you know, we talk about language. It's funny, and I got a note from you, and you made such a good point of this. You said, we Yanks are English-ocentric, but now because of the global trade, and this is happening really in all the industries, it's probably better to open up your mind and maybe learn some at least basic phrases. If you were going to jump on some languages, obviously Spanish we know would have to be one of them. But what else do you think people should learn if they were going to try to broaden their base, maybe just to get a little friendly with some business?
Well, the old expression is where you sit depends upon where you stand. So if you are in business and much of the sourcing these days by business is done in what's called low-cost sourcing countries. That would be India, particularly China. China is the manufacturer of the world these days. So in addition to visiting the country, it would be polite. The Chinese would view it as being polite if you would learn to speak a few words in Chinese. Hello, or how are you doing, things like that. It's probably very difficult for someone to learn to speak Chinese, but the It looks so much more inviting. You seem so much more respectful if you go out of your way to learn a few words of the language. So Chinese would be a big one for people doing business overseas. That's by far the biggest one right now.
Yeah, I agree with you. I went to school in Madrid for a while, and I found that the people were very embracing. If you just tried to speak, Robert, you know, you just gave it a good effort, they would help you. If you stumbled, they weren't making fun of you. They would just tell you what you were actually struggling to say, and I thought they were very gracious about it. And I really believe if you just make that little effort, that's what happens. You can reach out, and you can accomplish a lot more. Hey, you even, I guess, speak a little bit of Russian, but that was because of a girlfriend, right?
She helped improve my Russian, but I was learning Russian because I was looking at a business opportunity, and it was really necessary to speak the language. So in a fortunate happenstance, I happened to meet a woman who had newly emigrated from Russia to the United States, and she became my coach-in-chief in learning the language, and it was a good experience all around, shall we say.
Can you tell us something in Russian, just anything?
Yeah, here's how Russians will say hello, and it's very it's peculiar on the American ears. They will say, Здравствуйте, как поживаете, which is hello, how are you?
Tough.
It's really odd on your ears. So the short version, like if you were going to speak to your French-Canadian friends, ça va, mon ancien, the short version for friends is, как дела? Which is a lot easier.
Wow. Yeah, no kidding. I'm going to have to play this back several times to get that, and I'll quiz the listeners on that, too. Hey, we started off saying that, you know, you grew up speaking French, but you grew up in a town in Rhode Island, right? Did you grow up in Rhode Island?
That's exactly right. Woonsocket, Rhode Island. Not the edge of the earth, but you can see it from there.
Ba-dum-bum. That was pretty good. I got to give you credit for it. So did everybody, when you were a kid, I mean, obviously you were in the United States, did everybody pretty much get the French-English thing?
Well, it was spoken almost like you see today in immigrant communities. There has long been a big French-Canadian population. In fact, in a lot of New England, where there are all the mills, they were populated by French-Canadians who came down from Canada because a lot of the mill owners, especially textiles, came from France. So there was a big population, and you would find newspapers. The French was the language that was in the stores, in the schools.
Wow.
Speak French. So that was, I just grew up assuming everyone spoke both languages, but now I know better. So let me ask you, what do you call someone who speaks three languages?
There's a joke in this, I know it. And you probably told it to me. Trilingual?
Trilingual. Two languages.
Bilingual.
Just one language.
I don't know.
American.
That's brutal. Well, you broke the mold then, because you're American, you spoke two, and now you're on your way to who knows how many languages you're going to end up speaking. Since that's what you do, you're all about the negotiation thing, this would help in, you know, there used to be a beer commercial, and it was the guy was going to Japan, and he learned some phrases, but he butchered it. It was a very funny commercial. So you got to be careful when you learn a language that you know exactly what you're saying. But I would think in negotiations, in the art of negotiating, like you mentioned with the Chinese, that would probably help you if you just knew, like you mentioned, a couple of key things, just even the hello, how are you, right?
Well, I think it puts you, the language is the gateway to the culture. And if you understand a little bit of the language, you are closer in touch to the people, and you see how they react when they say certain common phrases, or the expressions, the French with their hands, the Japanese, they're very, very much have no affect when they speak. And it's just a window into, wow, how do they think? Why do they act like that? And when you imitate it, you can't be afraid to imitate what they say or how they say it. That's part of speaking the language. And when you do that, there is a greater affinity. So there's a greater trust, and negotiation has a better foundation on which to build. It's not necessarily adversarial. There is a closeness that you wouldn't get without that affinity.
Yeah, no kidding. Robert, it was a delight having you on. And again, Robert's book is You Negotiated. Robert, again, thanks for coming on America Tonight.
You've seen our SinoFresh banner on the GCN website.
Yet your sinusitis is still a problem.
Are you waiting for your sinusitis to go away by itself?
Are you waiting for a SinoFresh discount?
Okay, here it comes.
But first, the facts.
67 other products merely treat symptoms.
And not the cause of sinus problems.
And 37 million Americans suffer from sinus distress just like you. But now many are finding relief with the only patent-protected homeopathic nasal product that antiseptically eliminates the known causes of sinusitis. SinoFresh.
Now, here's your limited-time discount offer to use SinoFresh.
Call 888-906-3636 right now for $2 off per bottle when you mention GCN. That's it. Just call 888-906-3636 and mention GCN for a $2 discount.
But hurry, this offer is only for the first 1,000 customers.
Call 888-906-3636. 888-906-3636. Call right now for $2 off per bottle.
Mention GCN.
Buy SinoFresh.com. It works.
Hi, I'm Mark Craighead, founder of Crossbreed Holsters. I designed our top-selling holster, the Super Tuck Deluxe, to solve the problems of being poked, pinched, and gouged while carrying concealed. The Super Tuck Deluxe is the most comfortable, most concealable holster on the market today. We offer a 2-week free trial and a lifetime warranty.
Visit us at crossbreedholsters.com. Don't forget, crossbreedholsters.com.
Hi, this is Ted Anderson. Have you ever wondered why banks, stockbrokers, investment advisors won't talk about gold IRAs? They've been available since 1986, yet the financial industry won't recognize the value of gold for your retirement. Gold has outperformed paper investments, yet no word about IRAs. If you would like to have gold for your retirement, call 800-686-2237. Don't get left behind by rising inflation and low returns. Call 800-686-2237. Secure your future and call 1-800-686-2237.
AirandAqua.com is your one-stop shop for some of the most affordable air and water purification systems available on the market today. AirandAqua.com knows exactly what doesn't belong in our air and our water, and they know exactly how to help you rid your home or office of these harmful toxins. Did you know that your skin actually absorbs more chlorine while you shower than from the water you drink? AirandAqua.com can help you eliminate dangerous chlorine from your water. AirandAqua.com carries atmospheric water generators, glass water bottles, chlorine reducing shower filters, air purifiers, water ionizers, filters that remove up to 95% of the fluoride in your water, whole house water purification systems, solar powered lawn and garden products, water testing kits, and more. Visit airandaqua.com. That's airandaqua.com. Or call 1-866-380-2782. That's 1-866-380-2782. airandaqua.com. Purify your life today.
Imagine going 230 miles an hour, pulling 12 G's, and flying 10 to 20 feet over the water through an obstacle course of inflatable gates. I can imagine it, but I don't know that I would have the guts to do it. Our next guest, Alex McLean, knows what it's like. He's a pilot who's part of the Red Bull Air Races, and how exciting is this? They're going to do this all, I mean, they've done it all over the place, but they're going to do it in New York City on Father's Day weekend. Alex, thanks for joining us on ATN.
Thank you for having me with you.
Let's talk about, first of all, you're a pilot, so how did you jump on this Red Bull? How did you get involved with Red Bull and the cool machines that they're flying and this world championship that they're doing? How did that all, you know, take place for you?
Well, I mean, in many ways, I'm still asking the same question to myself. I'm from Europe, from Spain, and I was, you know, for many, many years, I was doing air shows and aerobatic flying, you know, competing worldwide. And, you know, about 7 years ago, Red Bull just gives me a phone call and, you know, hi, we're Red Bull, and we're kind of doing this kind of air race. I had no clue what they were talking about. And, you know, would you like to come and join? And I said, yeah, why not? I mean, that was the very, very first Red Bull Air Race, and that was 7 years ago. And since that date, and I tried it, I got pretty scared, and it was a completely new concept. And I fell in love, and I got hooked to the air race, and up till today.
Yeah, 7 years. What? Take us back to your first flight, because I was describing that, you know, screaming through the air the way that you are, and you know, in those planes. What was the first flight like for you?
Well, I mean, the first flight in the Red Bull Air Race, I mean, as I said, it was, first of all, it was pretty scary, Because, I mean, you used to fly, I mean, I was used to flying stunts and doing, you know, upside downs and all kind of maneuvers, but not to fly so low and so precise. You know, you have to go through pylons, through gates, which are, you know, about, you know, about 20 feet wide, and the plane is about, you know, pretty much the same. So you have to be very, very precise going through these gates. So it was, it did require a lot of, you know, a great challenge and a lot of skills, and all those things together just hooked me. I mean, just the concept of having to fly, you know, so precise, so low, so fast, it was just, you know, pure adrenaline, and it was just great.
Yeah, you're an adrenaline junkie like a lot of us. That's what I'm thinking. The inflatable gates.
Well, yeah, I mean, and those who are not is because they haven't tried.
Yeah, exactly. The inflatable gates. What happens if you, have you ever hit one? What happens if you hit one?
Oh, we do hit gates very, very often. I mean, it's not what you want to do because, I mean, you get penalties. But they're incredibly well designed. I mean, I think that they put an immense effort in designing them. And, I mean, when you hit them, from my perspective, being on the plane, I mean, there's a bounce and a shake on the plane, but nothing too dramatic. And they just basically explode. And I think they do cost a fortune. I don't know the exact figures. But every time we hit them, I think someone is going like, ouch.
Really, I bet. Have you, okay, so have you ever had an accident in these planes? You never had an accident, right?
No, not in the air race, no. I mean, I had some accidents during my flying career. I mean, which is, you know, you ride horses, you fall off horses. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's, it happens. But, I mean, nothing dramatic and nothing that has stopped me from flying. I mean, just teaching lessons.
How far away are the spectators from the planes? Are they kind of, you know, I'm thinking of the Blue Angels and some of the other things we've seen with precision flights before. Do the spectators get to come pretty close to you?
I would say, I mean, close enough to get the feeling and to get the smell and the you know, and the feeling of speed and the noise and all. I mean, close enough for that. But they, I mean, the distance is just, you know, it has been studied from all directions, I mean, to be a safe distance. So, I mean, in the event that something happened to one of us, you know, with the planes or anything like that, they're, you know, far away in order to be, you know, damaged by any possibility of something happening. But they're still close enough to get the whole feeling and the whole, you know, show of seeing the planes flying low between the gates. So it's quite a, I mean, I don't know if to say, you know, too far or too close, but definitely at a safe distance, and that's priority number one. I mean, you know, while we do the air race, I mean, priority number one is safety. Safety of spectators, safety of everyone around, and of course of ourselves.
So when you were a pilot, and you are a pilot, but you go from one aircraft to another, and this aircraft has to be pretty lightweight because of the precision. It's got to be a high-performance plane based on the speeds that we're talking about. It's had to be a different feel, or it has to be a different feel controlling this. What is it like when you're actually behind the controls? Is it, I don't want to say easier, but what are the differences in flying this kind of a plane?
Well, this is kind of wild. I mean, this is, the feeling is just a wild feeling, a brutal feeling. I guess if you compare it to the cars, I would say this is like a NASCAR or like an Indy car, or, you know, for those who know, or Europeans, you know, the Formula One. I mean, this is like the most. I mean, they have an immense power. As you said, they're very, very light, very incredibly agile. I mean, they move like bees in a way. I mean, and flying one of these machines is just awesome. I mean, in terms of, you know, the maneuverability of the planes, I mean, the way they handle, it's just great. I mean, they're not meant to be stable. They're not meant to be comfortable. They're just meant to be racing machines. And because of that, I would just define it as wild.
And you fly all over the place, of course. And, you know, as I mentioned, the next stop is New York. That's got to be exciting, too, right? Because this is a global thing. You're all over the place.
I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, we're incredibly privileged. I mean, we go all around the world. We started the season this year. This is the fifth race of the season. And we started in Abu Dhabi, which is the Emirates, so like Saudi Arabia. Then we went from there to Australia. Then we went to Rio de Janeiro and then to Canada. Then now in New York, and then we have another three races to go back in Europe. I mean, how cool is that? I mean, is just being able to fly on, you know, all these places is just absolutely incredible. And it's an incredible privilege to be able to fly. New York, as you said, I mean, I think that out of this season, this is the race, because racing in New York, in such a city with so many people, with so many different cultures, with so many languages, with so many, you know, everything, It has everything. It's like, you know, getting all the whole world in one city. So it's just, you know, it's going to be a great feeling, and I really, really hope people enjoy it. And I will enjoy, like, just seeing people around.
You know, the other thing is, too, your fellow pilots, they're from all over the place, France, Canada, Germany, Japan, Russia, the United States, and England, too, as well. And, you know, you get points, right, for every time. Is it points for the maneuvers you do and then points for winning a race? Is that how it is?
No, I mean, just points for winning races.
Okay,
I mean, basically, you get points for, yeah, if you're number one in one race, you get like 15 points, and then, you know, down from there. And basically, they add up all together, and you get a world champions. So we have 8 races this year, so you will have 8 local champions and then 1 global world champion. And that's how it goes. It's pretty simple.
Yeah, so now and you've got, I was checking the standings, am I right on this? You have 4 points.
Yeah, I mean, which is, I mean, you know, well, I was going to say between you and I, but, you know, hopefully many people listening. I mean, so between all of us, I mean, that's really bad. I mean, this season is so far being one of the worst seasons in all my career, which is pretty frustrating. But I guess, you know, racing just, you know, it's like that. You know, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, and you have to be prepared for both. And, you know, it doesn't really depend only on you, but it depends on the, you know, on the whole, on the machine, on the racing plane, on the engine of the racing plane, on the prop, which would be equivalent to the tires on a car. I mean, it depends on so many things that if you don't make it right on the off season when you're getting ready and you're preparing your machinery and yourself, and it doesn't work out, well, you know, it's what it is. So you have to learn from it. You have to keep positive, keep trying your best, and definitely prepared for the next season.
And with the planes, how do they move? I'm just thinking off the top of my head when you're going from Windsor and to New York and all those places in between. How do you move the planes? Do you fly the planes? Does everybody just fly their planes in?
Well, yes and no. I mean, it's a pretty awesome thing about, you know, the organization. When we fly the plane, I mean, obviously when we have races like from, you know, the Emirates in Saudi Arabia to Australia, they have to be flown by 747s. So they basically freight a couple of, you know, 747s, and they put all the planes and all the, you know, all the kind of the whole thing, the whole stuff. They put it in a couple of big, big, big planes, and they travel around the world. Now, when we fly, you know, when we race in Canada and we have to come to New York, in this particular occasion, then we flew our own planes, which is not ideal, but, I mean, they're pretty fast planes. It took us 2 hours to come from Detroit, I mean, Windsor, which is Canada. And, you know, pretty fast planes, but really uncomfortable to fly and cruise around.
Yeah, boy, I understand that. All right, New York should be a lot of fun. I want to tell everyone to go to RedBullAirRace.com. It is a very cool thing. Alex, we wish you the best. I hope you win in the Big Apple, and thanks for coming on America Tonight.
I mean, I hope I win as well. I mean, thank you for having me with you, and really, I mean, try to come, try to see the race. It will be, you will, all of you will enjoy it. You know, and it's a great thing, and we just need you. I mean, we need you guys to understand our sport and to live the sport with us and the passion.
Absolutely. I can feel it here on the airwaves, so everybody go check it out. And that's Alex joining us, wishing him the best in this race in New York from all of us from America Tonight.